Hi, this is Nate Allen from Good St. Nathaniel, and this is my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say
you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Dominate.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I have to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Being realistic.
As the story grows.
I always wanted to be part of a small rebellion.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it. Boom.
In the darkness, when we acknowledge our need, when the hurt meets restoration. When forgiveness reaches deep. When the fall.
So technically welcome back, but this is also technically your first time on As the Story Grows. Is when you talked to Travis, it was still Black Vinyl Collective, which was a long time ago. Not that long ago, but a long,
well,
long
enough almost time. 4 years. I mean, that's a
that
feels like a long time. Like that whole high school career.
Yeah. oh man, it is. That's crazy. Yeah. When you're older, it doesn't seem that long ago. But
no, it's just like 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago. But
Yeah. So you have this new project out. This new record you're releasing called Hide No Truth. And I wanted to start by asking you, you decided to change up your moniker and release this under the name Good St. Nathaniel. Why the branding shift for this record?
We really settled on the fact that I have Destroy Nate Allen, which is the moniker I've used for, I mean, a long time now, has really become synonymous, at least in our minds, with a project between my wife and I, which is kind of silly punk rock. And needed something to set the two apart, in our minds especially. And for me personally, I needed an outlet for solo work. And it felt like Good St. Nathaniel was kind of a character, an idea that I could work with for a while. So we decided to choose that new name.
Okay.
So I'm not... Yeah, so, I mean, there's tons of symbolism behind it for me, but the main thing was just, like, separation so that the different parts of my creative world could exist or kind of coexist.
Well, what makes this so different from your Destroy Nate Allen, outside of not being, like, silly punk rock or whatever, which it's not?
No, it's not. I think this is different. It's almost completely the opposite. The only thing that they would have in common is maybe acoustic instruments and my songwriting. But even that, like, so Destroy Nate Allen shows, when they're carried to their logical conclusion, they end in group hugs and sweaty piles with people, you know, celebrating this moment. And when I am done with the Good St. Nathaniel show, people either come up and say something very meaningful or they just walk away in thought and silence. And it's like the experiences couldn't be much more different emotionally. Yeah, and sonically as well. So one, Destroy Nate Allen just gets louder and louder and louder and louder when you just keep carrying on and playing more and more shows. And Good St. Nathaniel seems to have the opposite effect, where the longer I do it, the quieter it gets. The new record I have coming up is like me trying to like it's just the more we record, I'm like, oh gosh, we're just going to get to like that whisper. Can we even capture like that broken whisper? I don't even, it's like harder and harder.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. In the press release for the new album, I'm just going to quote it. It says, Nate uses religious language to explore human vulnerability and his own broken Christian religious experience. I wondered if you could expand on that, what you meant by that.
Yeah. So I wrote a record about my Christian faith experience, which is the thing I know the best. I've got a lot of history for me personally. 12 years of Christian school, pastoring, just church attendance and weird places, and lots of like those little weird conflicts that happen just because people are broken and weird, and also major things. So like that's kind of like my broken Christian experience that I'm talking about, which to me I began to process through the lens of spiritual abuse, and that actually was really freeing because it allowed me to have a way to take this kind of like unnamed black cloud in my history that I didn't know how to discuss and start to work through it, where I could decide which elements I really believed and what I really identified with and what was just like residual buildup of trauma from my formative years. So like that's the broken Christian experience I'm talking about. The aspect where I talk about religious language is that as I've been sharing my stories, which are heavily from an experience of someone who was raised in institutional Christianity, people well outside of that framework have like been like, oh my gosh, I totally connect with you. I've never experienced religion. But the commonality of the human, you know, post-traumatic situation if somebody's been in, say, an abusive or a highly complex situation, they pretty quickly identify with what I'm singing about, which is well outside my, like, perception of, like, oh, if I'm talking about a story that was based in, like, a conflict over a youth group concert in the Christian music scene, like, those that I do on the record, like, I didn't expect that story to translate into somebody who'd like never been to a youth group concert in the Christian music scene, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Did you have someone give you a hard time at a youth group concert for something you said?
Well, it seems
to be kind of fun.
No. Well, I don't know why you would be. I think there was the multitude of complications around just trying to figure out how to be like, in my world, like a Christian punk kid also going to a Christian school with like just all the complications of that. Right before, like I got into punk in 94. So like Green Day was my gateway drug. And, I was also from the Northwest. So Nirvana was like the dominant cultural influence of the whole region. And I was also going to these dysfunctional Christian schools that didn't know how to deal with kids that like Nirvana or Green Day. And so their response was literally to kick out like half of my high school. Like any kid with an alternative taste, pretty much got kicked out. Except I was good, unless you were good at sports, and I was good at sports, so I didn't get kicked out. It was really a totally weird double standard. So that was the like the culture I was being raised inside of. I had no choice. And so in that there was these kids that were still drawn to rock and roll, but we weren't necessarily like the super edgy ones. And so there was all these weird theological battles, I guess you could say, or philosophical battles. And there was one concert in particular where I was trying to this band, The Deadlines from Tooth and Nail, had been booked, and they had to cancel last minute, so I grabbed another band to play. And long story short, I'd asked them not to preach at the show because we told some kids we weren't going to preach at them. It was just kind of a basic agreement. because they specifically requested us not to preach at them. And so, long story short, this band starts preaching, and I'm like, hey, guys, can you stop? Like, and then they kept going on. And, I mean, we're talking, I think I asked them 3 or 4 times to stop.
Oh, man.
And then they started overplaying their set, and then kids are leaving because they're getting offended because they're not just, you know, preaching. It feels like they're accusing them of all sorts of stuff, and it's just a big complicated mess. And so what I ended up doing was pulling the power on the stage, which is my best friend was in the band at the time. And so they were pissed, as high school kids probably would be. And cut came over to my house a few days later, and they wanted to resolve the situation. And by resolve, what they wanted me to say was that I was completely wrong, and I completely repent. And to this day, I don't really think I was wrong. And so high school Nate was already stubborn enough that he would not admit. I didn't admit I was wrong. I just said, I'm really, really sorry I offended you. And this loop of behavior went on for at least 30 minutes until I was literally weeping on the ground in front of these guys. Just saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And they just kept tearing into me. And it didn't end until I literally just got up and walked out, like, kind of dragged myself out of the room. And so, like, that experience actually, like, when I look back at the complexity of my life, there's an area where I became much more conflict avoidant after that interaction and never regained those friendships and never regained that space of like, everything's just going to be okay. I understood, like, I just never really recovered. So, like, now, years later, even in therapy and stuff, I'm like, I've revisited this particular memory a lot, and it makes its way into the new record. And I'm like, man, I'm processing stuff from like 20 years ago now. And seeing like how that has weaved its way into my story and, you know, against what I would like, has really informed and shaped who I've become.
Now that's some heavy fucked up stuff.
I would agree. I would completely agree. And I mean, that's kind of indicative of this album I've putting out. It's kind of it's exploring those sorts of things. Those really, really, intense interactions, often for me, because it was the experience I knew around the complications of faith, particularly in light of somebody who likes rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I really enjoy the new record. I actually probably like it more than a lot of the Destroy Nate Allen stuff. Yeah, it's a record I definitely like. You want to sit down with the lyrics and deep dive into it, because it seems like there's a lot of heavy themes going on. And from that story alone, you can tell that there's some heavy stuff going on this record.
Yeah, I mean that's one verse of a song. That's literally one verse.
We'll get into the songs a little bit. How'd you hook up with John Terry, who recorded and mixed the record?
We live in Kansas City, and the band Listener lives in Kansas City, so we work together.
Okay.
In various capacities. John is the one in the group who's the producer and as a friend, so we decided to do it.
Okay, cool. And then Jim DeMann mastered this record?
Yeah. He was a recommendation from, I don't know if anyone knows the name, John Mark Painter. He was in Fleming and John.
Oh, yeah.
Old school. I mean, he's been around forever. But yeah, he recommended Jim. And then I looked closer into Jim's like collection of work, and I'm like, oh man, this guy's done a lot of awesome stuff. And actually, the way I chose Jim is I had two people master songs. Jim and T.W. Walsh mastered songs for me, and they each mastered a single, and I sent Jim a version of my song Lightning, and he listened to it and goes, and sent me an alternative mix where he added more thunder and lightning sounds to the song.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, huh, this professional, like, very well-regarded mastering engineer just added stuff to my track because he thought it needed it. That's pretty cool. And so I felt like he cared, and so we went with him for the whole record.
That's cool. Yeah, the press release said you assigned different friends to add whatever their vision of noise was to each track. What was the idea behind that?
To me, I settled on just the acoustic versions of the record, and it felt stark to me. I wanted to add, like, another layer, and I'm not good at adding... I'm good at songwriting. I'm not good at the rest of it. So I asked anybody... I put out a Facebook post, and I was like, hey, who wants to make noise on my record? And the first people that responded, I just sent them a song and said, hey, do what you do on this track, whatever your vision is.
That's cool.
I mean, it was keyboards, guitars, somebody looped my voice. There's all sorts of weird stuff on there. The album notes try to explain it the best I could understand it.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm always interested in people who do creative packaging or marketing for their record, and one of your pre-orders is a good Saint Nathaniel candle.
When I decided on the band name, I'm like, I'm making a prayer candle. I don't know if anybody will understand. I think it's funny and it's slightly serious because the whole record is pretty serious. So like I don't know if they'll like it or not, but so far people seem to think it's pretty neat. And so I'm glad we did it.
No, I think it's clever. I think it's
only in my home region of Oregon have people been weird about it. Somebody was loading out for me to show, and they're like, let me carry your idols for you. It's like, I think we need to talk. Yeah, it's funny.
That's so funny. So let's talk about, can you talk to me about the opening track, Everything That's Lost?
Yeah. So I don't think anybody knows this. I haven't told anybody. So there's two versions of Everything That's Lost. Everything That's Lost, there's a version that came out in June. And there's a version that's going to be on my record. Timbre, who's played with a lot of different people, Me Without You, Jack Black, and many others, recorded harp on the version that's on the record. And so nobody knows that. That's exclusive to the podcast. So basically, that song, I think, encapsulates what I would believe is possible and hopeful. I have, like, a complicated family history. I mean... This record doesn't even touch on my family issues. But it is a complicated enough story that, like, for me, I'm like, oh, like, I really wish my family could have been different. If I could time travel, I would, like, you know, stop my grandpa from hurting somebody and stop his dad from hurting somebody. Like, the real story is just complicated. And the more I look into the parallels, I'm like, man, my church history and the church history is just about as like fucked up as my family history. In really like the complexity of how people hurt each other and how that just kind of the cycle builds. And so being an optimist and somebody who believes in redemption, I think the song to me is aching for maybe a recovery that we might never see in this time frame, in this life. And so, like, I'm not Catholic, so I don't have, like, you know, beliefs of purgatory, but I feel like there is a space that's like, man, if somebody has been subconsciously reacting their entire life and hurting a ton of people, and maybe in the afterlife they realize how much they hurt people, that there will be a chance for them to, like, make right what they've done wrong, because they finally realize it. And I don't know how that like fits theologically with anybody, but I would love to see, like, say my grandpa who hurt a bunch of people, like, realize why he was hurting people and be able to, like, undo that mess.
Yeah, like it's reactionary and circumstantial and not like a conscious choice of badness. Is that what you're hinting at? Yeah,
totally. I think my story essentially involves this 30-year chunk of my life where I was, I would say, the victim of abuse of various kinds. and I didn't know how that affected me in the moment. I have altered thousands of conversations to not talk about faith topics. I've, you know, literally run down the street to avoid being associated with churches before. Because of that pain package in my past that I didn't understand. So there's like, I've done all this stuff that was without any idea of what I was reacting to. And I'm like, and I was really lucky to even have a moment where I'm like, oh gosh, I think this is like, this is what this is. This is abuse. Because I feel like it started giving me back control over choice. You know, maybe instead of running, I now feel the anxiety. And really like realizing, man, there's a lot of people that have no idea what the cause, what's causing their reaction or their problems. I mean, like, Richard Swift just, there was an article in Rolling Stone about.
Oh yeah. Yeah. About his passing.
And, I mean, in some ways it's really textbook, man. The guy had an abusive father. And he was also part of what I would say was a really destructive portion of the Christian music industry, which in my hand are both abusive situations. And then he had a lot of things that you know, just started kind of like building. And I think unless you can kind of pause and start unraveling some of that, it really does build to a lot of stuff you can't control.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was really, that article was really heavy. It felt very familiar to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe building off that, I mean, how do you feel when you approach faith or Christianity outside of any church or organization or structure? Like, I mean, do you still have a spiritual connection or?
I think I do. Okay. I would say my faith is more enjoyable than it's ever been. And I would say that I feel like it's my own choice. So like realizing, okay, I do believe this funky, weird, mystical, complicated religion. Like it's what I've always known and it's where I've ended up and kind of settling. So that does make sense to me. That's a personal choice. I do still attend the church. And actually a lot of the songs on this record, I've played at church for the first time. And every time I play a song, I literally have a panic attack. Cause it was so like intense. I'd be like, oh gosh, I'm playing one for a Christmas service and then be like, okay, I'm going to go walk the halls for 15 minutes and like reassess myself. Within the structure, that's still a thing. And outside too. But so on a personal level, I still have faith, and I think it's more my own choice. I've been able to start to untangle the mess between the people's behavior in the name of Christ, and I think the some of the basic tenets of Christianity, and be like, oh, Jesus actually did say to love your neighbor. He didn't say to like punish them using the word of God as like a disciplinary weapon forever. I think there's a lot of contradictions that people can choose. I mean, I went to Christian school was like a, you know, if you were in trouble, you were being a bad Christian. And then if you were like, and then they just make you write Bible verses all the time. So like, I just became like, it was very complicated. I'm like now in hindsight, I'm just like, dude, that was like the best way to make somebody like, you know, not want anything to do with what you're selling.
Yeah.
Use it as punishment.
Yeah. All right. We don't have to go track by track on this record, but I know you put out a music video for the song Lightning. So I wondered if you want to talk about that track and what made you choose that track.
I wanted, there's three songs that will be coming out on the record. I wanted to use in advance. I wanted to kind of display the kind of three, what I felt like the three major movements were. And so there's a handful of songs that are finger picked and Lightning was one of those. And it felt like it was a song that had the most, like, universal appeal that nobody had heard. And it also, I mean, so, like, it's from a hey, this is a new project standpoint, it made sense. This song to me is about power and, like, what happens when somebody in power hurts other people, or, like, the negative fallout that somebody's actions have, whether they're, like, I remember I had a pastor who, I'm not really sure if there was infidelity involved, but he was removed from office. And I'd been friends with him, and I had worked under him, and then I moved away. And so, like, we're talking, there's 1,000 miles between us, I haven't talked to him in a couple years. And when whatever happened with him happened, I still felt the emotional fallout. You know, a couple years and 1,000 miles away. And so, like, realizing that if somebody is in power and they choose a destructive action that has, like, a widespread effect in its wake, and I think the more power somebody has, the more influence, the wider that wake is. And so that's what kind of started the song. And then I realized, man, I have the same capacity. So, like, my influence isn't not necessarily, like, even, that big. But I know that my negative actions can totally affect those close to me, like, really quickly. And the larger my influence is and the larger my mistake is, it resonates. And so for me, it's like, oh, crap, like, I was telling my wife, because I screwed up the other day of something, and I was like, oh, I got a song about that. She's like, you've got a lot of songs about that, apologizing. because it's, I really hate hurting people. So, and then the other half of it means I attempt to, you know, say I'm sorry. It's not always easy, but, like, so the song to me is a little bit of an apology and a little bit of a case study in power.
So, maybe I'm reaching here. Were you involved in Mars Hill?
I was, well, want another exclusive to the podcast? hey, Mars Hill people, I was not involved with you. I'll go there. This is a thing. If you don't look it up, or you can't look it up, I don't care. Years ago, one of my all-time rock and roll heroes is Jeff Suffering, from 90 Pound West. He was like,
yeah.
He altered the game for me in 98. I know exactly where I was when I saw him for the first time. And he completely set the standard for live intensity. I don't care who you are, nobody else that I know has ever come close, in my personal perception of, like, what blows my mind. So fast forward, you know, well more than a decade later, we're friends, we've planned a show in Seattle, and this is at a house show in Seattle, and Jeff's like, hey, do you want to cover something Must Break with me? I don't know how to play power chords. I asked him to play it. And I was like, yeah, that's all I know how to play. So I'd love to, like, play Something Must Break, like my favorite punk rock song from my high school years with you.
Yeah.
And so we play it. It's on video. It feels really cool to play the song with him. So that's the thing. And Jeff was a Mars Hill pastor, and I've known that for years. And we were friends before that, and we're friends after, and during. So, like, I didn't really think anything of that connection because I'm just playing a house show in Seattle that he happened to set up. And so, like, somebody that was at the show decided to write this article on the Mars Hill blog about how awesome the show was, which to me is, like, non-issue, cool, whatever. It's a little tiny blurb. Never thought anything of it. A couple years pass, and I'm at a show, and I get completely blindsided by a girl who is just ripping me up one side and down the other for, like, being associated with Mars Hill. And I have no idea why. I'm just like, whoa, 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 whoa. I've never been to that church. Like, I didn't play there. Like, or actually, I have been to a service. I'd never, like, played there. I'd never been, like, I'm part of a Mars Hill event. I have no idea what she's talking about. And it completely, like, I mean, it blindsided me completely as a show. I know exactly where I was standing. And so I looked it up, and there was a website that was an anti-Mark Driscoll website that hated Mars Hill for being too liberal. And they wrote about how Mars Hill was evil because Mars Hill supports evil punk rock. And the example of Mars Hill's evil sin of liking punk rock was Jeff Suffering, Nate Allen, and one other friend. And I'm like, and so if the person would have actually like read the article, they would have realized that no, we're all being thrown under the same bus here. But in the reality, I just got the like somebody who'd probably been hurt by Mars Hill or didn't like Mars Hill ripping me up, and I'm like, so that's my complicated kind of Mars Hill story. So, yeah, it was a mess. And I haven't talked about it. I did my best to bury the story on Google because I didn't want more of that fallout. I was just like, yeah, I looked it up in incognito browsers and stuff.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah, no, I just asked because some of what you're talking about sounds similar to Nate Burke was just on the show, and he kind of talked about that a little bit. So,
yeah, I mean, I think there's a commonality. And I mean, I'm a Northwest kid, so I mean, that's not, I remember Mars Hill before it was an issue, where it was just like this rock and roll church that, as far as everybody I knew that was part of it, or even just a general cultural association with it, didn't really have an issue with it. They just thought it's kind of a church.
The first song you released as a single out was the album's closer, Better.
So this whole record the record's pretty terrifying to me because it involves me talking about not just vulnerable issues of my past, but one of the main fallouts of the abuse I experienced is I didn't want anything to do with discussions of Christianity. Or the label of Christian in public. That was like, if there was one like thing that I would run away from, it's like that sort of thing. And so the whole process has been like me literally being like, okay, here's another level of like vulnerability and risk. And so what I want, I kind of eased into the record, if that makes sense. So Better to me is like the album's closer. It's probably the most hopeful song. And it feels like it's the softest interaction with people. Like I'm trying to like ease them from like, I'm in this weird punk band to I make this really, really, really serious music now. That's like so different. So I'm trying to like bridge that gap as gracefully as possible. So Better to me would have been like a slow song on a Destroyed Allen record. And here on the Good St. Nathaniel record, it's like the happy song.
Awesome.
If that makes sense, it's not that happy, but it's happiest.
Sure, sure. So you said there are three songs you wanted to showcase.
Yeah. There's a song called Heaven. It's going to come out in a few weeks. That's like, I feel like the record has a handful of songs that I would say are fingerpicked, a handful that are kind of strummy folk songs. And then there's all kind of minor chord dissonant songs that are a little, kind of approached differently. And Stephen Mark Sorrow actually played on a song called Trust that's on the full record. And when he's like, I don't know if I got anything for this track, and he sent me his mixes, and he had added like a layer of reverb to the songs, and like or his songs. Like, dude, I like that so much. I'm gonna remix the whole thing with reverb now, and it really fit the like minor chord eerie aspect of it. So,
what's the theme for Heaven?
Heaven is, it's a song that I wrote in the time of my grandmother's passing. So there's an element of struggle with, like, you know, it's time to go, but you don't want to leave because, like she had a moment where she's like, I see angels, they're calling me home, but I don't want to leave yet because I have to see my daughter. And so there's literally this, like, this pull, push and pull back and forth, which I think a lot of people experience when it's the end of life. But also, my grandmother was the tool of implementation of legalistic religion in the family. So in some ways, the song is a kind of an ode to her, and also just like me exploring the cause and effect of the heritage I was passed down through that portion of my family. So I think so it's kind of exploring what I got from her and also exploring the tension of that moment with her.
So the record comes out February 1st. What's the plan? Are you going to tour the record or?
I'd like to. I will have more music in the can, but like the idea is to tour the record. I've stopped playing shows until I get the record out. Because it just was like, there's just not enough of me to go around to do both. So I will hopefully tour. I might do some stuff in February, and then my goal is to try to get into the South. I really want to see what happens when I play these songs in the Bible Belt. For better or worse, I feel like there's an element of this record that is, I feel like it's the most punk rock thing I've ever done in my life, to sing about my approach to religious experience this way. And so playing, like, churches is really fun now, because I feel like I'm, like, setting off, like, little emotional bombs. And which can be really, actually really healthy, I think. And the places that I've played have been very appreciative. But it's just like, dude, I'm doing something that I never would have done before. Like, I avoided these places for a decade. And now when I go back, I'm, like, kind of, like, carrying this, like, musical and emotional gun. So it's, like, it's kind of a trip. So I really want to get to the South and just see what happens when I play, like, this record in, say, like, Nashville or Alabama or something. So. Yeah, I mean, I definitely want a tour, so that's the goal.
Yeah.
So hopefully enough people will be interested in the record that when I go on tour, people will show up. I'm used to playing small clubs because, you know, I've always just been this independent guy and without too much foothold. So the idea is trying to build some support before I, like, just climb on the road next time.
I think we can do better. A whole world better than this. Yes, I think we can do better. A whole lot better. A whole lot better than this. Yes, I think we can do better. Treat the whole world better than this.
Thanks for listening to As the Story Grows. Our theme song was written and composed by the legendary Bob Nana. If you like what you hear, subscribe on iTunes and give the show a rating and review. If you'd like to support the show financially, click on the Patreon link at asthestorygrows.com. If you enjoyed this episode, share it on social media with your friends. Much appreciated, and thanks for listening.
I never felt so young and alive as when I'm diving into a tomb. And now I'm learning as I listen along, and the wheels are turning and I started a song. As the story grows.
world.